From KXJZ in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, should Sacramento air quality officials limit fireplace use on bad air days? Plus, a disco-era version of Shakespeare's Twelfth Night. First. Bob Livingston plays country, but his musical horizon extends well beyond Texas. His latest project involves musicians from India. Bob's in town for a concert at the Palms. We'll talk in a minute. But first, here's Rainin' for So Long.
It's been raining for so long. I can't remember what it's like to feel the sun. Everybody's walking with his head down. It's been raining for so long. Last night I was hoping for a nice tomorrow. I was hoping for an early start. But in between the lightning and the thunder, we may need another ark. It's been raining for so long.
Bob Livingston, welcome to Insight.
Very good to be here, Jeffrey. Thank you.
Well, this song comes from an album called Mahatma Gandhi and Sitting Bull. Could you explain the title, please?
Well, it's something that I probably have regretted because some of these DJs in Lubbock, after they play it, I was on with one show the other day, and he says, that was Bob Livingston with a song from Mahatma Gandhi and Sitting Bull. I mean, it's just, it doesn't compute, but it's the song, there's a song on it called Mahatma Gandhi and Sitting Bull, and it just seems when Sitting Bull defeated the United States Cavalry at the Battle of Little Bighorn, he immediately went into show business. He joined Buffalo Bill's Wild West. They toured all over the world reenacting that battle and other battles, and Buffalo Bill ended up in London in 1893. Queen Victoria was sitting in the stands. And she was so taken with the spectacle, this multicultural spectacle with Zulu warriors and Maasai tribesmen and mounted riders from all over the world, Hussans and Cossacks and Vaqueros and, of course, American cowboys and Indians out the kazoo. And American flags waving, star-spangled banner going, and she stood up and saluted the American flag when it came by, the first time in history a British monarch had done that, through the power of music and entertainment. And so Gandhi was actually in London at the time, and I started thinking, a friend of mine, Bobby Bridger, and I wrote the song, and we started thinking, what would happen if these two Indians of this disparate background had met? One, a man of peace, turned the other cheek, and the other a man of sort of a violence to achieve an end, and what would they talk about?
My guest is Bob Livingston, and he's in concert tonight at the Palms in Winters. You have a spiritual frame of mind. Is that the source of the nickname Cosmic Cowboy?
Well, you know, Michael Murphy, who I played with, wrote that song. He said I inspired him in some way. Sometimes the Cosmic Bob moniker is not as, you know, I sometimes wish I could shed it, but I think
on your
I've
website.
Always, you know, I know. I think I've always been sort of leaning in that direction, and you know, my head in the stars a little bit, and the Cosmic Cowboy came out of that, Cosmic Bob, and I've, you know, I made it to India, and you know, I continue that tradition.
And we'll talk a bit more about India a little later, but you have your guitar with you and your harmonica, and you're going to sing a song for us. What are you going to sing?
This is called Original Spirit. It's on the record, too. She lives down south where the rivers age, goes back to the original spirit. And the India ink's flowing over the page, down to the original spirit. And the rhythm of life is still one among the original spirits.
takes that to the sacred ground where the ancient music is playing. She begins to sing as the rain falls down, like a thousand voices were praying. And the clouds have all gone, and her light shines on her original spirit. And I want to see that I'm a part of that original spirit. Where my aim is sure, and I ride that royal road. Yes, I know the truth when I hear it, and it's original spirit. So take me down south where the river's age goes back to the original spirit. And the India ink's flowing over the page down to the original spirit. And the rhythm of life is still young. Yes, it is. And we are all at one with the original spirit.
Very nice. Bob Livingston, he's in concert tonight at the Palms in Winters. Let's talk a little bit about India and cowboys and Indians.
Yes.
Indians as in people from India.
Right.
How did you come to go to India? It was through the State Department, wasn't it?
It was. My background was a Texas country folk rocker. Played with Jerry Jeff Walker, Michael Murphy, Los Gonzo Band. We used to play all over this area of the world back in the day. And one of the kind of off times, I had a chance to go to India, and I took it. And I met a Fulbright scholar over there whose name was Frank Block, and he was a lawyer, and he told me about this program the State Department had. It was like a cultural exchange. And if you could convince him you're an expert in whether it's being a professor of hydroponics to country music, you might be able to get a gig. And I thought that was fantastic. So I went to Madras at the consulate there and auditioned. I told them, here I am. And they said, well, let's see what you got. And the guy was just looking. I remember the State Department guy was just kind of staring blankly at me when I was playing. I didn't know what he thought. And finally, he just said, do you mind? And he reached down and pulled out a banjo. And he goes, I've been waiting for you to walk through this door for a long time. And he says, I'll tell you what, I'll put you on the road if you let me sit in every once in a while. Of course, it's a banjo, you think twice. But he wasn't half bad. And he was a vice consul there at the State Department. And so I came back the next year, and I toured India. And over the years, we went into Pakistan, Nepal, Bangladesh, been all over the Middle East.
What did the people of India and Pakistan and so on make of country music?
Well, they love it. And the way it was explained to me, which was an epiphany to me, is once I was introduced, Mr. Bob is here to play the country music of America and to learn the country music of India. And it's really the music of the country. And they see country music in the same way we do. They have their same love and loss and sadness and exhilaration, all those things. You know, they don't have too many cheating songs and sitting in a bar crying in your beer, but they have a lot of folk songs. It's really folk music. And that's kind of what I am. I'm a folk singer.
Well, back in Austin, you put together a group of musicians, both country musicians and Indians.
Yes. When I started playing with Indian musicians while I was there in India and on these tours. And so about 92, 93, I started thinking about how cool it would be to come back. And so I guess it finally in 1996, I came back and on one of the trips, and I thought I'd put together a group, and I found some Indian players and a Bharatanatyam dancer, this woman that does classical dance, interprets the lyrics, and we put together this group called the Cowboys and Indians. And I started writing grants, Texas Commission on the Arts and the Austin Arts Commission and other concerns, and we started getting funded, and so we can go in and play these schools. We do a lot of schools and play a lot of theaters.
How do these two kinds of music work together?
Well, for instance, once I was in India and I was playing, and this man, he was a great tabla player. And he was a tabla, you know, is the little drum that if you've ever seen Ravi Shankar, and there's a Ala Rakar is his name, is the drummer, and he plays this. It's make him talk. It's just the most intricate thing, and so far advanced. They play in time signatures like 6.5 and 17, and this guy was saying, "I don't think East and West can meet. You just play, and you know, I will. I'll play, and then you play." And I go, I'm telling you, it'll work. And he's saying, "I don't think so. I don't understand this Western beat." And I said, "Do you know this? We do this kind of thing.
Buddy Holly."
And he goes, "Oh, you mean that beat? Well, of course I know that beat." And it's like the Bo Diddley Buddy Holly beat is this primal beat in all cultures, I think. And he started playing right along. So suddenly it was like country and Eastern, or ragabilly, I like to call it. And, you know, I don't do too much different. I learned some, you know, time signatures and some modal tunings and stuff like that. But for the most part, I just rely on the expertise of these Indian musicians to play.
And you have a song, Cowboys and Indians.
I do.
You can play for us.
And this is sort of the title track. We're turning it into a musical, and with the Zachary Scott Theater there in Austin.
Changing the harmonica here.
I'm changing the harmonica. You have to have different keys. Here we go. And this is the Cowboys and Indians. Some cowboys and Indians that came riding across the sand of a blood red painted desert, lone equestrian. Sometimes red is black and black is white. Mortal colors vanish from your sight, but not the cowboys and Indians. Visionary drifters on a timeless caravan, sticking close together when things get out of hand, sharing in an unspoken word that each and every one of us has heard. Cowboys and Indians. Oh, 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 oh. Sacred. Carry on. Through the lost horizon, went into disguise, and carried on. Thank you.
And they're never without focus, always on a sacred trail. And it's absolutely guaranteed their steps will never fail. Oh, the wheel is turning, even standing still. And the wisest men know never to reveal. The cowboys and Indians. Yeah, oh, cowboys and Indians.
Here's your part.
Oh, 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 oh. Cowboys and Indians.
Great. Bob Livingston. The song is Cowboys and Indians, and he's in concert tonight at the Palms in Winters. And I want to make sure we have time to play another clip from your album, Mahatma Gandhi and Sitting Bull. And this is the song, On a Dream With You. Let's hear a little bit of it and then we'll talk about it.
Okay.
On a dream with you. Life is simple and moving slow. Like holding hands to the radio. There's no other place we wanna go. On a dream with you. After all those lonesome nights, on a dream with you in a villa in New Mexico, wearing your boots with your evening clothes, and the band is playing soul Creole.
Back in Austin, you probably heard of her. She's really come on strong here the past 3 or 4 years. It's just great to see someone that is writing such vital and relevant music these days.
How do you feel about the country music today?
Well, I don't think it's very vital. I don't listen to country music very much, at least the radio stations. I like this, you know, I'm like one of those guys that you've heard a million times. Well, I like the traditional stuff, the stuff that, you know, there are a few. And I think that some guys like Brad Paisley, he can really play that guitar and he's good, you know, and even Keith Urban has some good songs. But for the most part, I can't tell the difference. You know, I don't listen to it that much.
You live in Austin. Is Austin still a center for more vibrant kind of country?
Oh, absolutely. You know, you have South by Southwest, which is like 1,000 bands or something like that come. And I heard someone talking about it the other day, and it's really not for the fans. It's for the industry to hear the new music. And they come from all over the world. And people move to Austin, and it's difficult for an old codger like me to get a gig in Austin anymore because there's all these young bands that'll play for free, just like I used to be.
Yeah. Well, I noticed in your website that you and a couple of other musicians are doing a thing called the Cosmic Cowboy Cruise that happens in February.
Yes.
And it sounds very nice. I was just wondering, you know, back in the early 70s when you're playing bars with the Lost Gonzo Band, would you have imagined that you'd be going on State Department cultural tours in India and doing cruises out of Galveston?
No, it's all a dream. it's all a beautiful thing. And, you know, I always knew I was going to try to get to India because it always really, just the fact that I could actually get paid. And we're going to Vietnam. I'm fixing to go to Vietnam. My son and I, Tucker Livingston's a really great guitar player. And your listeners can look him up, tuckerlivingston.com, as a matter of fact. And he's in India right now. He's coming back, and we're doing this tour to Vietnam and Thailand and Sri Lanka coming up in January. So we're still sticking it out. I love it. I just love it.
Well, Bob, thank you so much for coming by. I know it was a bit of a rush. You just flew in from Austin not too long ago and on your way to your gig tonight at the Palms. I appreciate you making time for coming by our studio.
Thank you very much. I hope everybody shows up tonight. It's at the Palms. We want you there.
That's Bob Livingston, tonight at the Palms. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, a disco-era version of Shakespeare's Twelfth Night. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callis. And next time in Insight, that will be tomorrow, Sacramento Bee baseball writer Nick Peters is retiring after a 47-year-long career in sports journalism. His final game is tonight, which by chance is the same night that Barry Bonds says goodbye to the Giants, and Nick will be in San Francisco. Also tomorrow, you'll learn about a visiting UC Davis student's work with Afghan refugee widows, and you'll hear about a local film that follows a veteran's return from war. Disco hadn't been invented when Shakespeare wrote Twelfth Night, but Sacramento Theatre Company thought the hedonistic 70s would make a good setting for the play, so expect the music and fashions of the disco era in the production of Twelfth Night that's playing now. It's put on by STC2, the Sacramento Theatre Company's young professionals company. The actors are on the young side, and the main intended audience is on the young side too. Joining us are two actresses from the production. They're Shiva Shamir and Rebecca Scott, and the play's director, Matt K. Miller. Matt, Shiva, Rebecca, welcome to Insight.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
Thank you.
And Matt, in your case, is welcome back. We talked to you a few months ago when you were playing Iago,
right,
for Sacramento Theatre Company's main stage.
Right.
Do you often direct plays?
I don't. At STC, I am a company member, artistic associate, which means I'm generally known as an actor there. So, in fact, I'm appearing, we begin previews in a week for Mice and Men, in which I'm playing George on our main stage.
So you're playing one of the two lead roles in that show while you were directing Twelfth Night.
Right, rehearsing Twelfth Night while I was also rehearsing Mice and Men.
So they're keeping you busy at STC.
They keep me very busy, but I like it. I like being busy.
Okay. Well, tell us a very short description of what we need to know about Twelfth Night, because in a moment we're going to talk to two of the actresses and we'll even hear a scene. But what do we need to know about Twelfth Night?
Twelfth Night's a very fun play. It's arguably Shakespeare's best comedy. A lot of people, it is their favorite comedy of his. Basically, a set of twins, a boy and a girl, are shipwrecked in the same place, a town called Illyria, but they both think the other has drowned at sea. The girl, in order to protect herself, dresses as a boy because it's a strange land and she doesn't know anyone. She goes to work for a duke who she falls in love with but doesn't reveal her true identity. She stays his boy's servant. He, meanwhile, the Duke, sends her to woo a woman that he's in love with. Well, that woman falls in love with the disguised boy.
Wow.
And chaos ensues.
Very nice. That's Matt Miller, director of STC2's production of Twelfth Night. Now, Shiva Shamir and Rebecca Scott are in the show. Shiva, who do you play?
I play Viola, the twin, one of the twins.
And how big a role is that?
Well, quite big.
Okay. Tell us about that role. What's interesting about it? What was the challenge for you in it?
Well, I have to disguise myself as a boy, and there's many variables thrown at us. I mean, the 70s, an English language we somewhat understood, and me disguising as a boy. So it was very interesting, and you just had to change your form of thought.
Yes. And Rebecca, who do you play?
I play Malvolio, Olivia Stewart.
And is that a big part?
It's a sizable part. It's not, Malvolio isn't really part of the main story about the lovers and Orsino and Viola. It's sort of a side story, more of the comedy side.
Have you acted Shakespeare before?
Yes. A few years ago when STC2 did A Midsummer Night's Dream, I was Puck. And when Sacramento Theatre Company did Taming of the Shrew, I was in the ensemble.
What's it like doing Shakespeare?
it always kind of feels a lot like singing. You know, you have to breathe in certain places. You have to emphasize certain words. The vowels get stretched out, and it's in different places in your voice. You can go high or low. So that's always sort of how I've thought of it. It's just very much like singing.
Is it harder or easier, do you find, to do than more contemporary theater where people are talking in a way that we're used to hearing?
I actually prefer Shakespeare. I think that the way that he's written his dialogue and the text that he gives you actually puts things out a bit more clearly what he intends. You know, if you say it, then it's really something that means something. And I've personally always found when I do contemporary shows, there's a little bit more reading between the lines and you can go a bit farther with that. So when Shakespeare just kind of lays things out very clearly.
And Shiva, have you done Shakespeare before?
I've done a little work with Julius Caesar, but not a full production.
And how are you finding the words of Shakespeare?
Well, I was scared at first because I was like, Viola, she has all these monologues and I have to memorize these words and I haven't even heard these before. But the rhythm really helps, the iambic pentameter. It's like the beating of the heart. And so it really helps to memorize.
You're going to do a scene for us from the play. Matt, could you tell us what we might need to know before the scene starts, just so we know where we are?
Sure. Rebecca plays Malvolio, which is actually a man in the show. And Malvolio is Olivia's steward, basically her head butler, if you will. Olivia being the object of love of Orsino, the Duke that I spoke of. After Olivia's first encounter with Viola, who's disguised as Cesario, she falls in love with her. She sends Malvolio after him to bring him a ring, which is a ruse by Olivia. There really was no ring, but she wants to get to see Cesario again. So she sends Malvolio to bring this ring and insist that Cesario come back and see her. Malvolio is a very unpleasant person. Not a lot of people like Malvolio. In fact, they play a lot of tricks on him in the play. So this is their encounter.
Well, very good. This is Rebecca Scott as Malvolio and Shiva Shamir as Cesario / Viola. It's a scene from Twelfth Night at STC2.
Were not you even now with the Countess Olivia?
Even now, sir, on a moderate pace, I've since arrived but hither.
She returns this ring to you, sir. You might have saved my pains to have taken it away yourself. She adds, moreover, that you should put your lord into a desperate assurance she will none of him. And one thing more, that you be never so hardy to come again in his affairs unless it be to report your lord's taking of this. Receive it so.
She took the ring of me, I'll none of it.
Come, sir. You peevishly threw it to her, and her will is it should be so returned. If it be worth stooping for, there it lies in your eye. If not, be it his that finds it.
I left no ring with her. What means this lady? Fortune forbid my outside have not charmed her. She made good view of me indeed, so much that methought her eyes had lost her tongue. For she did speak and starts distractedly. Oh, she loves me, sure. The cunning of her passion invites me in this churlish messenger. None of my lord's ring, why, he sent her none. I am the man, if it so be as 'tis. Poor lady, she would better live a dream disguised. I see thou art a wickedness wherein the pregnant enemy does much. Oh, how easy it is for proper faults, for woman's waxen hearts to set their forms. Alas, our frailty is the cause, not we. For such as we are made, as such as we be. How this fadge. My master loves her dearly, and I, poor monster, as much fond on him, and she, mistaken, seems to dote on me. What will become of this, as I am... Man, my state is desperate for my master's love. As I am woman, now last the day, what thriftless sigh shall poor Olivia breathe? Oh, time, thou must untangle this, not I. 'Tis too hard of a knot for me to untie.
Very nice. Thank you so much, Shiva Shamir there and Rebecca Scott in Twelfth Night. Matt, what was the challenge for you as a director to work with these young actors and actresses to be able to do Shakespeare? What did you have to teach them?
Well, a few pretty simple rules, really. And I love that Rebecca brought up the analogy of music. Just as when you learn music, there are a few rules. But once you have those rules, the music itself is open to interpretation. So it was just a matter of getting them to realize where the rhythms lie and where the emphasis should usually go and the importance of certain words and so forth. And they took to it very well, I thought.
Yeah. They're nodding. Matt, why did you or someone else at SDC choose to set it in the 70s?
That was my idea. Doing research on Twelfth Night, it's really about the music. Shakespeare is very smart. In this production particularly, he infused a lot of popular music of his day, which was very clever on his part because it certainly ingratiates the audience immediately. And when they recognize, hear songs they recognize.
Like they do with movies today.
Exactly. Same device. So I thought, well, obviously, those songs in the original songs in Twelfth Night aren't going to be recognizable. So I wanted to pick an era which had fun music and would be instantly recognizable and iconic. And I came up with 70s disco.
And so what music do you use?
I use a lot of Bee Gees and Casey and the Sunshine Band. And
I have to sing I Will Survive.
She sings a little I Will Survive. We Get Down Tonight.
Oh, yes.
Staying Alive. It's all really fun stuff.
Shakespeare was a businessman. You think he would have appreciated what you're doing, your idea here to refresh the play?
Well, I may flatter myself, but I think he would approve. I think he'd love the idea.
Yeah. Shiva and Rebecca, disco is, I regret to say from my perspective, before your time. Did it seem like a good choice of an era of music, fashion, and so on to you, Rebecca?
It was really surprising at first. We'd come to the first rehearsal and he said, oh yeah, we're doing disco 70s. And we were like, what? Because, I mean, you know, none of us knew that much about disco. But once, you know, we started seeing some of the costumes and he told us about some of the songs. And they were actually ones that we'd heard before, like, you know, Staying Alive, I Will Survive. And he'd say, hey, that goes here. And it was like, oh, that makes sense. Okay. And so we researched it on our part, and it all kind of came together.
Now, earlier in the summer, we talked with a couple of young actresses from SDC2 who were about to go to Greece to perform The Tale in a couple of cities in Greece. And you two were in the same production, I believe.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes, actually, I think that was me.
Yeah, how did it go?
That's
right, so you
were.
That's right. I knew you looked familiar.
Well. Yeah.
Tell us about it.
Well, it was very hot, and we had a pretty good reception there, I thought. Most of the people that we met, you know, we heard from our audiences that though they couldn't always understand what we were saying because of the, you know, language barrier, that when a certain character would come on and they portray a certain thing and you'd have some of the audience go, oh, hey, that's Hera, or oh, hey, you know, that's Zeus, and they could just recognize it by that, and that was very interesting, sort of.
How was Greece for you, Shiva?
It really helped develop my character, and especially since all the Greek gods and goddesses have natural characteristics, being in Greece and experiencing the weather and the ocean and everything really helped us develop our character, and we came in with a whole new energy.
Mm. Now, you're perhaps thinking about a career in theater, is that right?
I haven't got to that decision yet, but yes, it's definitely on my mind.
Yeah. And what about you?
Definitely.
Yeah. Well, Matt, the show runs until when?
It runs 2 weeks, but we're now into the final week. It runs Wednesday through Sunday. Evening performances at 7 p.m. Matinees are at 2 p.m. on Saturday and Sunday. And you can call the box office at Sacramento Theater Company and book tickets.
And then you're an off-mice and man. That sounds like a fun project.
Oh, it's wonderful. Just a wonderful team. It's actors that I've either worked with already or know socially very well. So we already have sort of an ensemble, intuitive way of working with each other. And
talk about an iconic story.
Yes, iconic indeed, and classically American. And it's so wonderfully simple but poignant, incredibly poignant. And it's just a joy, as it is to do any of those great plays. This is another one where it's just a joy to live in those words and those worlds.
Well, thanks all very much. As Twelfth Night runs through this weekend at SDC2, that's Sacramento Theatre Company's Young Professionals Company. Matt K. Miller, the director, and two of the actresses in the show, Shiva Shamir and Rebecca Scott. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Sacramento air quality officials are considering limiting the use of fireplaces on bad air days in the winter. We're going to talk about the arguments for and against when we come back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Ever wonder how we managed to cover so many topics and book so many guests on Insight? Interns are a big reason. You'll find details at cabradio.org. Should Sacramento air quality officials limit fireplace use on bad air days in the winter? They'll decide tomorrow, but today we'll hear the arguments for and against. The decision would be made by the board of directors of the Sacramento Metropolitan Air Quality Management District. In our studio is the district's executive director, Larry Green. Larry, welcome to Insight.
Good to be here, Jeffrey.
Why does the district think that fireplace use should be limited in the winter?
Well, if you remember those smoky days in early September when we had the Plumas County fire, we had hundreds of calls from people and people concerned about their kids. In fact, on those days, we were barely at the federal standard. In the wintertime, we exceed that standard 20 to 30 times, sometimes as much as three times. When we look at the inventory that's out there, almost half of that pollution comes from fireplaces and wood smoke.
And what is it in the smoke that's causing the problem?
It's the smallest particulates. The federal government, recognizing this, has just come out with a new standard in the end of 2006. They cut the federal standard in half, and we will not meet that standard in the Sacramento area.
I guess you would say unless the board makes the decision that it might do tomorrow.
That's true. Normally what we do when we have a new standard is once the standard's in place, we come up with a bunch of rules and regulations as to how we're going to meet that standard. Since we will not be finishing our paperwork on this till 2012, we have an opportunity to get ahead of the power curve and to demonstrate to the federal government that we're going to meet that standard. In fact, we hope to meet that standard by that time. One of the ways to do that is to go after that 50% of the inventory in wood smoke. And this rule is the third step in a series of rules our board has passed to try to address this very serious public health issue.
What exactly would happen if the board votes to implement this rule? It's Rule 421.
Would happen is that we would watch the air quality, and if we believe the next day is going to be a day where we would exceed the federal standard, we would call a no-burn day, called check before you burn. In other words, asking people before they burn to check their... And that would apply to wood smoke, pellets, and manufactured logs. It would apply to both residents and businesses, and time frame would be November to February. There's some important exemptions. First of all, if people use wood as their only source of fuel to heat their house, they're exempt from the program. Natural gas, propane, and electric fireplaces would be exempt. Cooking would be exempt, and fires during religious ceremonies. And we're also asking our board to allow me to make a determination for economic hardship. In other words, somebody who is really impacted by this could apply to the district, and I could give them a waiver from the rule.
Well, it sounds like a lot of possible exceptions. It sounds like a lot of paperwork for you.
It is paperwork for us, but during our workshop process, we've had over 19 public meetings on this, and you imagine we have had our ears bent many times by a lot of different people. We try to respond to those questions that the public ask, and we've tried to frame a rule that will address those particular folks that really do need a break.
How do you know it'll work?
Well, we know it'll work because around the nation, other districts have put rules in like this. In California, we've had the Great Basin, and down in Fresno in the San Joaquin Valley, they put a rule in 3 years ago. Both of the rules have been very effective and have, in fact, decreased that portion of their smoke by 30%.
Larry Green of the Sacramento Metropolitan Air Quality Management District. Let's bring in another guest. Peter Ross is a member of the board of directors of the California chapter of the Hearth, Patio, and Barbecue Association. He's also with the business Home and Hearth, Inc. in Sacramento. Peter, welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
What do you think about the Sacramento Metropolitan Air Quality Management District's proposal to limit fireplace use on bad air days in the winter?
Well, we understand the need to meet the federal clean air standards in Sacramento, and we support the district's efforts in many ways. We're currently participating with the district and have been for the last several years with their fireplace changeout program, which gives cash incentives to homeowners to upgrade from an old wood stove or older technology open fireplace to a clean burning technology such as EPA certified wood burning stoves, pellet stoves, or gas fireplace inserts. So we've been participating with the Air District, and we've worked with the Air District in their rulemaking process. We're all in favor of clean air. But our issue really here is that we feel that the district is undermining their own program in the first place by taking away the incentives for people to upgrade to clean technology by lumping the clean EPA-certified stoves and pellet stoves in with the majority of the older, dirty, polluting fireplaces and pre-EPA wood stoves. Okay. We feel the bulk of the problem are the old appliances. There's probably 95% of the fireplaces out there are certainly not EPA certified, and that the district could meet its goal and still leave the incentives in place for people to spend their money and upgrade their fireplace to a clean, responsible technology.
Well, let's see what Larry Green says to that.
Well, again, we certainly have heard the message here. But in looking at our percentages, we think about 7% of the air pollution out there is caused by these, you might say, cleaner burning devices. That 7% is important because if we're trying to meet the federal standard, we need 30% reduction. The other districts have gotten 30%. We'd sure hate to get to 2012 and find out we're 5% short and we're going to have to do a lot of federal rules. And that 5% could have been gotten from this particular part of the inventory. So we're recommending to our board to go all the way. Remember that our incentive program covers EPA-certified pellet stoves, but also gas fireplaces. Gas fireplaces are an order of magnitude cleaner than these other devices. And in fact, we will continue to incentivize all of those because we do want cleaner devices to be out there. But for this period of time, for the purpose of trying to meet this federal regulation, we think it's prudent for us to give all of the ammunition to our staff that we can and try to get down to that federal standard.
Peter, do you have other objections to the rule that the district board is considering?
Well, I would just like to point out that the pellet stoves, for instance, are extremely clean, and we question some of the numbers that the district has come up with and the percentage of particulate that they're attributing to these devices. I'm not sure exactly what studies have been done to show exactly how much of this particulate comes from pellet stoves, for instance, but it does seem a bit counterproductive when the Air District is encouraging people to put in pellet stoves, for instance, with the same incentive that they're encouraging people to put in natural gas stoves, and yet on the other hand, telling those people that even if you spend thousands of dollars to upgrade your fireplace under our own incentive program, we want to be able to turn around and tell you that you cannot use that clean burning, environmentally responsible appliance when we say there's a bad air day. The pellet and wood technology is a green, renewable fuel. I know that doesn't address the particulate issue, but the particulate issue is certainly just one small part of the whole big picture.
What about, setting that aspect aside, what about the notion of limiting fireplace use for perhaps about 30 days over the course of the winter when it's a bad air day? What do you think about that?
Well, we're all in favor of meeting these goals, and if we can meet them by discouraging or outlawing fireplace use during these bad air days, with the exception of extremely clean-burning appliances, or maybe coming up with a program where you could have a two-stage program, which I know the Air District has considered but isn't talking about, where in the initial there's an initial stage where people can burn clean, and then if things get worse, mm-hmm. can have an all-out no-burn curtailment program. We're not opposed to looking at various options, but we really feel that the current rule as drafted is going to anger a lot of people who, since 1992, have spent a lot of money doing the right thing and upgrading to EPA-certified clean technology and should be allowed to use that as a supplement to heat their home. There are many all-electric homes in Sacramento, and those people will be seriously affected. And regardless of whether the district says there's exemptions available, a lot of those people are not poor, but they do have high energy bills and would certainly feel impacted if they weren't allowed to supplement their electric heating bill with a clean, responsible appliance.
Another big player in the fireplace industry is headquartered in our area. It's Duraflame Inc., the maker of fireplace logs, and headquartered in Stockton. Vice President Chris Carone joins us by phone. Chris, welcome to Insight.
thank you. Thank you for having me today.
What does Duraflame make of the Sacramento Air Quality Management District's proposed rule?
Well, you know, we would certainly echo some of Peter's comments. We acknowledge that wood smoke is a contributor to the problem, but we believe the district's current analysis overstates the magnitude of that problem. There's two ways to look at emission inventory. One is to calculate emissions from primary sources. Another is to do an analysis of emissions that are collected on filters by chemical mass balance. And in this current analysis, we believe that the district has left out contribution of secondary particulates, which is a larger contribution source than wood smoke. So we don't think we're getting the whole picture. And if you include the contribution of secondary particulates, wood smoke is probably 18 to 20%. Now, that's still a large contribution source, but it's certainly not half. The other thing that we're concerned about with this rule, it's a mandatory rule, but enforcement is going to be very limited. So it's going to require people's compliance with the rule. The district is claiming from a survey that 78% of people would comply, and therefore they'd have a pretty significant reduction. But if you look at that survey closely, within that 78% of the number, about 36% of the people don't actively use their fireplace. So it's kind of hard to include them in the reduction calculation when they're not active wood burners at this time.
Mm-hmm.
So we think there's a little bit over a statement. And in that case, you know, whether you can really reach compliance on the back of wood burning alone is questionable. And if we can't reach it on wood burning alone, then we have a little bit bigger window to try to get to compliance. And I think the good news is that wood smoke's not growing in this airshed. The district has already taken action to put a cap on the growth of wood smoke by limiting fireplaces in new homes.
Yeah.
There are mandates that the new if people put in a heating stove, it has to be an EPA certified or pellet stove. So the emissions from wood burning aren't going to grow, which gives us opportunity to further promote clean burning technologies. And when you talk about fireplaces, the technologies are pretty limited. You either can convert to gas, which on the average cost about $1,200, or one technology is a clean burning fire log like those made by our company, which produce about 80% fewer fine particulates. 80% is a really significant reduction when it comes to control technology.
Okay.
People can use those products for about $3 per fire. That's 400 fires compared to the cost of $1,200 to put in a gas log.
Okay, Chris, we're getting short of time. I want to make sure Larry Green can have a minute to respond to what we've heard.
Well, I guess I would say that the inventory numbers that we're using certainly came from the Air Resources Board and from EPA verifying those. That's the organizations who pass the rules that we have to pass. Secondly, same for the percent reductions that we're looking for. We've seen the same reductions elsewhere. Regarding the Duraflame logs, we and EPA both would have agreed amongst ourselves in looking at the data that we do not see conclusive evidence that Duraflame logs are better than burning wood. And there are many situations where they could be worse. And there's also toxic issues that we would have to look at. We don't think it's appropriate for us to endorse wood or Duraflame logs in any case. And we would prefer to focus, as we talked about, on the EPA certified, the wood pellet, and particularly on gas fireplaces, which is what we're incentivizing with our program.
Larry, is this a done deal? Is the board likely to delay a decision? Are they likely to pass any amendments? And we have to be very short here.
I think we'll have a good discussion tomorrow.
So that means maybe?
That means maybe the board will pass this. We're hopeful that they will. It's an important clean air rule for Sacramento.
Okay. Well, thank you all very much. We will update listeners on what happens a bit later. Anyway, for now, thanks in our studio, Larry Green, Executive Director of the Sacramento Metropolitan Air Quality Management District, and on the phone, Peter Ross of the Hearth Patio and Barbecue Association and Chris Carone of Duraflame Inc. in Stockton. Thank you all very much.
You're welcome. Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. For more information about the guests and topics on Insight, go to our webpage, capradio.org/insight. Today's associate producers were Candice Mangachet and Linnea Edmeyer. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. The senior producer is Jen Picard. Thank you for joining us.